Joe O'Brien is the character at the heart of Peter Barron's latest novel, The O'Briens, a family saga that follows four generations of an Irish-Canadian family from the late 1880s to the 1960s, from Canada to California, and eventually to Maine through several economic upheavals, prohibition, and two world wars. The book, which reviewer John Vernon called impressive and a major accomplishment in his March 25th review in the New York Times, is published by Pantheon. I'm very pleased that it brings Peter Barron to our show today. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Although this new novel doesn't pick up exactly where your first one left off, should we think of the O'Briens as a continuation of the story you began with, The Law of Dreams?
It is, in a way. The two books aren't really related other than that The Law of Dreams was really the story of my great-great-grandfather who came across on a coffin ship in the 1840s. And this is the story of his grandson, my grandfather.
So in that way, it does. It's to some degree, you're drawing upon your family's history, except that you get to call your great-grandfather Fergus O'Brien.
Yeah, it draws deeply on family history and myth, though, of course, there was lots I didn't know about them, which is why I had to make it up and which is why it's a novel rather than a memoir.
And Fergus had emigrated from Ireland to Montreal during the potato famine. And you sat on a coffin ship. What's a coffin ship?
That's right, yeah. The coffin ships, the poorest of the poor were Irish immigrants in the 1840s coming out of starving Ireland at that time. The cheapest passage across the Atlantic was on a lumber boat going to Canada. These boats brought lumber to Ireland or England and had empty holds on the way home. Cheap passage, they'd pack them with Irish, dump them on the wharves at Montreal or Quebec, and that's basically all I know about my great-great-grandfather was that he came over on that ship and crawled ashore in Montreal.
And were you able to do much research into him? Because he probably would have been relatively anonymous, wouldn't
he? Yeah, he was an anonymous. One of the hundreds of thousands. I did a lot of research on them, the hundreds of thousands, and figured out a context and a setting for him. But I don't know anyone whose ancestor came over during the famine who has anything in the way of family stories or things. These people were so poor and I think also so desperate to get away from that poverty. It wasn't exactly passed down.
Well, in this country, the Irish were really discriminated against, in some cases not even allowed to enter the country for long periods of time, quarantined. Was Canada more welcoming? Because Canada usually has at least for much of its history, been a little more welcoming of immigrants from around the world.
One of the reasons hundreds of thousands of the poorest Irish went to the Canadian ports was that they were stopped from entering the United States, as you say, because of quarantines. The Canadians couldn't stop them. They were part of the British Empire. The ships left from Liverpool or from Ireland, and they sailed to another British port, Montreal or Quebec. That's why the so many arrived in those years.
Well, let's talk about the current novel. Yeah. When it opens, Joe O'Brien is living with his four younger siblings and his sickly mother in the Canadian wilderness while their father is away fighting with the British in the Boer War in South Africa. How old is Joe when he learns that his father's been killed?
13.
It's hard not to admire this kid. He begins cutting and selling firewood to support his family, and by the time he's 17, he's built a logging company that employed 30 lumberjacks. Is that something that also happened in your family's history?
Pretty much in its outlines, yes. My granddaddy O'Brien, I have to separate those two characters, the real guy and the guy in the book, but they're obviously related. He was a tough guy, came out of Nowhereville, essentially, and learned early on how to support a family and to make his way in the world in that very tough bush world of, you know, Canadian logging. I mean, that was him, certainly.
Well, in the same way that you proceed with the first book, I imagine that you're as much interested in how people fared in Canada during this time.
Yeah, I'm really interested in how the experience of emigration and ancient disorder and unhappiness plays out in contemporary lives. I always feel, though it's never mentioned in this book, that Joe is dragging the famine along with him. Ireland is never mentioned in this book. This is a family like my family, not at all interested in the past. Nonetheless, they kind of live with its weight attached to them.
Well, Joe and his four younger brothers and sisters receive some of their education and financial support from a local priest who's been banished to the Canadian wilderness after disgracing himself in New York. What did he do to deserve that?
Well, I felt it was time to have some. And there's another character in there who's a nun. And both of them are kind of wonderful, enriching people. And I felt it was about time to show some. In the world that I grew up in, you know, very often nuns and priests were astonishing people. They were the only people not living their lives by these materialist precepts that everyone else was. And amongst that crowd, there were certainly some twisted sisters, but there were also some gorgeous, illuminating, complex people who were wonderful examples. And two of them end up in an all.
But Joe abandons the lumber business.
Well, he does and he doesn't. I mean, what lumber is really about is contracting. He learns how to hire tough guys, take them into the bush, work them really hard, make money, and move on. And that's, he just keeps doing that in a bigger and a bigger and a bigger way. He ends up contracting to build hundreds of miles of railway, running gangs of 5,000 guys instead of 30.
And then the family kind of splits up. The most of them go their separate ways.
He sees himself as their father. He tries to arrange lives for them in the world. He lodges them with various orders of priests and nuns, and then takes off. He feels it's his job as the guy to paterfamilias. He's going to make a lot of money to take care of everybody.
Was it typical for families at that time to lose touch with relatives, in this case, who had joined religious orders?
If they joined a cloistered order, certainly. I had two aunts who went into a cloistered order in Ottawa in 1916 and were never heard from again. I mean, there was simply no contact. Died in the 60s, I believe.
And then Joe moves to the United States. Would that have been seen as a step up, or is it?
It's really not relevant to him. What he really does is he makes a lot of money building railroads, and he wants a house by the sea. The sea to him speaks of the larger world, of a feeling of connection, of luxury and ease. He meets a young woman in California. They build a house there. Later on, he owns a house in Maine. It's about being by the sea, really.
They have three children, and he makes his fortune building railroads, later running construction business. And he's a terrific businessman, devoted husband and father. But he comes close to losing his family because he can't control his alcoholic binges. And we're talking about a man who's really controlled, so it kind of seems out of character for him. Is that the point you're trying to make?
You know, Joe, he's the kind of guy, one of his children, I think at some point in the book, says being loved by daddy felt a lot like being hated. It's definitely a controlling, constraining love. He wants to guard his family. His whole role is seeing them vulnerable. He's kind of like the male tiger prowling around the cubs, guarding them from the world. That's what he feels like. And that's, you know, that's kind of wonderful and also kind of awful. It's not a way to grow up. That's very much who Joe is. He has he fears the world for his children. And guess what? I mean, he raises them in the 20th century, which is going to reach out its cold hands for them. So there's a lot to guard them against and a lot that's going to be beyond his power to protect them from.
Well, we normally think of alcoholism as an ongoing situation, but I used to work for a guy who would suddenly have a binge and pretty much destroy everything. He'd show up at clients really seriously drunk, lose a client, major client, and then have to rebuild his business. And that's kind of like what Joe is. What leads him to this, to these sudden binges?
You know, he's a puritanical, patriarchal, paterfamilias, trying in his best manner to do all the right things. And yet I think the unexplained, unexplored things in his own past, in his family's past, even in the Irish past, every now and then reach out this hand of sorrow and grab him. And that's when he hops on a train in Montreal and comes to New York, takes a tower suite in the Pierre, and is found 3 days later by a chambermaid lying on the floor with a room full of bottles. And the family's phoned in Montreal saying, will someone please come and pick Mr. O'Brien up?
My guest is Peter Behrens, whose latest novel is The O'Briens. It is published by Pantheon. The lives of many of your characters are damaged by war. Joe's father was killed in the Boer War, as we said. Then his brother Grattan returns from World War I and has what we would probably call PTSD today. The youngest generation find their lives changed by World War II. Would it have been impossible to write a family saga that spanned this time period without dealing with these wars, or did you also have a special interest in including them?
I think they just kind of got in the way. My characters, as my family did, lived through the history of their times. And the history of their times, there's just no way to walk around these wars.
And then you wind up shifting focus to Joe and Isolde's children. They become the central characters. But much of their story is trying to emerge from the giant shadow of their father.
Yeah, and much of their story is trying to understand their father, this mysterious guy in his study on the second floor or in his office in the Sun Life building or sprawled on the floor of the tower suite at the Pierre. Daddy's a mystery.
As I mentioned when I was introducing you, this saga covers not only a great many years but a lot of ground. Aren't many of the places where the O'Briens settle places you've lived in at some point in your life?
Yeah, I can only seem able to write about places that I really know in a kind of depth and texture and tactile sort of awareness. And these happen to be family places too, but all the places that are in the book, Santa Barbara, Maine, New York, Montreal, the Canadian wilds are places that, yeah, I'm deeply grounded in.
Well, you're originally from Montreal.
Yep.
But nowadays, you split your time between your primary home in Brooklyn, Maine, not the same as Brooklyn, New York.
Brooklyn with an I in Maine, yep.
A house that you and your wife rent each winter in Marfa, Texas. These are both small towns, a bit out of the way. Do you prefer that to the big city?
You know, I hadn't really thought of this until this winter, but I think in some way I'm kind of living my grandfather's pattern. I'm certainly not making huge miles of money building railroads, but I also want to live a life kind of unconstrained by geography and at home in the continent in some kind of way. And moving back and forth between two homes doesn't unsettle me. It sort of grounds me. It's also nice to head into that Texas light in January when you live in down East Maine.
Well, it's probably easy to drive and park trucks in a small town, and I've read that you're a big fan of vintage pickup trucks.
It's my train spotter side.
You publish a blog about trucks?
I do. I have a blog, and I grew up as a little boy absolutely fascinated with trucks. Don't know why, because my family were very urban. My father was not in the slightest interested in things like that. I was obsessed. I stowed that obsession for a long time, and in my middle age, it's just run loose. So I'm letting it flower, and I'm buying junky old trucks, and to my wife's confusion and dismay, and driving them around.
Your first novel won the Canadian Governor General's Literary Award for Fiction. Are you still thought of as a Canadian writer, despite the fact that you live full-time in the United States?
I hope that I am thought of as a Canadian writer. I guess I feel really shaped by my background in ways good and bad. It's an identity that I'm proud of. I think I am a Canadian writer.
Well, not only these two novels, but you also published a collection of short stories called Night Driving in 1987. That's 20 years before the Law of Dreams was published. Yikes. What were you doing in the interim?
19 years. I was writing screenplays. That's what happened. I began, after I published that book of short stories, one of the stories was optioned in Hollywood. I was hired to write a script. It kind of went on from there in life.
And in a review of the book in the Washington Post, James McElroy suggested that this book, The O'Briens, would make a remarkable miniseries. So has there been any discussion about turning the book into a movie or a TV miniseries?
There's been some discussion, and if Matt Damon is listening, we've got a role for you. We're hoping.
So would you want to write it? After all, you've been a screenwriter.
I sure would like to have a crack at it.
And are you still writing short stories?
Not so much. I'm working on another novel. Novels seem to have the grip on me these days.
Well, when you write family sagas, in a way, it's kind of I won't say it's kind of like writing short stories, but you can think of things as sections as being the equivalent of a short story, can't you?
In a way, yeah. I felt to cover the 60 or 70 years that this book covers, I simply didn't want to cover every year. I wanted to pick the most lucid or pellucid or poignant or dramatic moments and be there and then pull out. So in a way, it was like choosing a story.
Peter Behrens' latest book is a novel called The O'Briens. Behrens, by the way, spelled B-E-H-R-E-N-S. The book is published by Pantheon. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.